But I got to explore things that you couldn't explore in real life and maybe you wouldn't want to. But it definitely provided an outlet for the emotional resonance of what you kind of collect as you go through that career.
Hi, I'm Ebony, and I believe that stories change lives and everyone has a story worth telling. Sometimes, unfortunately, we let our self-doubt get in the way of us writing our stories and sharing our stories. So that's why I created Motivation to Write as a source of motivation and inspiration to help writers like you and me share our stories with the world. So I talk to the experts ranging from entrepreneurs to marketers to authors to therapists to psychologists who share their knowledge and their advice to help writers like you and me step into our full potential. Frank Zaffiro is an author, podcast host, and retired police officer of 20 years. In 2006, he published his first book, Under a Raging Moon, which became the first book in his River City series. He's written over 30 books and collaborated with 5 different authors on more than a dozen of them. Frank is also the creator and editor of the novella anthology series, A Grifter's Song. In 2013, he retired to teach law enforcement at the college level and to write full time. His experience as a police officer inspires his creativity and his role as a crime fiction author. I am happy to have you because you are a retired police officer of 20 years. That's a long time. That's a long time. So you have loads of experience that has obviously fed into your writing of crime. Is that crime a novelist? Is that your genre? What do you call it?
Yeah, crime fiction.
Crime fiction. You've written 30 plus novels, and you have an interesting experience as an author with having collaborated with other authors and being at one point a hybrid author, right? So let's talk about how this career as a police officer led into this career as a writer.
I would say it fed into the writing career, but actually being a writer predated my law enforcement career, not professionally. I mean, my first book was published in 2006, and I became a police officer in 1993. So obviously the law enforcement career came first. But I was one of those people who, from 10, maybe 13 at the latest, really identified as being a writer, and that was my career goal. And so I just realized, even at 13, that you don't just hang out your shingle and say, I'm a writer. Somebody starts sending me checks, and it doesn't, work that way.
Start selling checks?
Yeah, people start sending you checks.
Sending you checks. I thought you said selling checks. I was like, wow, what is that about? At 13.
That would have probably kept me out of a career.
Yeah. Exactly. So people sending you checks. That was kind of the vision you had that, okay, that's.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't work that way, right? I mean, you don't just, whereas a lot of jobs, as soon as you get the job, you have a steady paycheck. And so, but I always saw myself as a writer. I started writing very young and kept writing throughout my, young adult life. And had some short stories published, when I was 20 or so, but I found myself in the early 90s, with a wife and a kid and just getting out of the military, after a 5-year stint and, got to put bread on the table, right? Got to put food on the table, got to pay the rent. And at that time, I thought as a secondary career is how I saw it anyway. I always looked at being either a teacher, a lawyer, or a police officer. Those were the career fields that really interested me. Sitting there with that life situation being what it was, I needed a 4-year degree to be a teacher, and I needed, I think it's like 7 to become a lawyer. And I already, thanks to going to school while I was in the military, had enough college credit to apply to be a police officer. So, that was one of the reasons why I went that direction. And so I did become police officer in 1993. And I kept writing. In fact, the first draft of what became my first novel Under a Raging Moon was finished in 1995, a couple of years after I came on the job. But after that first, you know, and even in the first year, there's so much to that job that, you know, I spent all my time, you know, learning how to become a police officer. And then I became a training officer. And, you know, then I became a corporal. And then I was a detective. And then I was a sergeant. And so I was learning a new job or a new position every couple, 2 or 3 years. And then at the same time, I went back to school full time and was getting my history degree, my undergraduate degree. Oh. And so while I did a lot of writing in that time period, I was writing police reports and I was writing papers for school and so forth, and not a ton of fiction. I really didn't crank up writing fiction yet until about 2004, when things stabilized for me career-wise.
Mm-hmm. So when you were 13 and wanted to become a writer, what genre were you writing mostly at that age?
Total copycat stuff. You know, what was I reading? I was reading science fiction and fantasy. Mm. So I was writing science fiction and fantasy with the occasional, you know, side trip into like military fiction, because I was a 13-year-old boy, you know?
Yeah.
But mostly crime fiction, or I'm sorry, mostly science fiction and actually mostly fantasy. I was reading, you know, in addition to Tolkien, I was reading Piers Anthony and Lloyd Alexander. And that was when I first tried to read Dune, which is a very complex book for a 13-year-old, and I struggled with it. Just these types of books.
And so did your career as a police officer, is that what kind of directed you into the genre of crime fiction?
Absolutely. Yeah. After not writing fiction for, you know, almost a decade, and I became friends with a guy who became one of my writing partners, Colin Conway, who was also a police officer at the time. And we just kind of hit it off, and we started talking about, we were both getting back into writing at the time, and neither of us had really known each other as a writer. And so we struck up a friendship and kind of started encouraging each other. And when I started writing crime fiction is what came out. And I'm sure that's because, you know, it's where a lot of my thoughts were at. It's what I was dealing with day in and day out. And so that's what led to that.
I'm wondering, did you find it therapeutic to write about all that was happening? Because I'm sure, yeah, you saw a lot as a police officer. So was this therapeutic for you to write this crime fiction?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I wrote some stories from bad guy standpoint. So I got into the mind of suspects. I had police officers doing things that you wish you could do, tell off a supervisor or something like that, you know? and so there was some wish fulfillment in there somewhere, I'm sure. But I got to explore things that you couldn't explore in real life and maybe wouldn't want to. But it definitely provided an outlet for the emotional resonance of what you kind of collect as you go through that career. Because you're right. It is one of those careers where you do, you know, there is a collective weight that kind of grinds on you. And then there can be some sharp incidents that can be even more traumatic at times. And writing, you know, people who go through traumatic experiences will often journal about them. Mm-hmm. And I think writing fiction is comparable for some of us and provides that same sort of relief.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, I really have a lot of respect for people that write fiction, because it's not easy. I mean, it's just, it seems like there are so many things you have to think of as far as plot and character, and just in engaging the reader emotionally. How did you learn that craft? Did you take courses, or was it just lots of practice, or?
I took a course when I was in the military on a creative writing course, and that gave me a little bit of a framework to call back on. And I read a number of books on it. And some of those books, How to Be a Writer, you know, some of them just are terrible. I mean, I'll be honest with you. Like anything, any how-to book, there's some that are great and some that aren't. But one that resonated with me was a book, actually a few books by a writer named Gary Provost. And Mr. Provost unfortunately passed away back in 1995. But I was reading two or three of his instructional books, including one called Make Every Word Count, in the late 80s when I was in the Army and writing and really kind of trying to figure out what that meant. And he did a good job of blending craft and things that you need to learn at a foundational level to be successful with the more human elements of it too. I mean, almost the spiritual elements of it, what you need to do to be able to be successful emotionally throughout a career. And ironically, one of the things that he said, and it really stuck with me, was how important it was to find another writer or a few other writers that you could connect with, that you could, you know, form a fellowship with, because as he famously wrote, or at least famous in my mind, that, you know, sometimes another writer will understand what the rest of the world does not. And that's true in any profession. Like, you know, I mean, it doesn't matter what profession you're in, people who do the same thing understand it in the way that people who don't do it don't understand. But it makes a big difference when you can share your joys and sorrows, and especially the sorrows of your writing career, with somebody who understands why you feel the way you do about it.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's talk about some of those sorrows, because did you go through a lot of rejection?
Oh yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Pummeled, you know, with rejection, and, you know, some of the earlier stuff, you know, 100% merited. You know, it wasn't a subjective thing for my early work, like I think it is with many writers. It, you know, objectively wasn't good enough. And then I think as you get better, the rejections become more subjective. Well, this isn't a good fit, or I didn't like this, you know, as opposed to this just flat out sucks. But yeah, I was very discouraged early on with all the rejections. And it wasn't until, and that really didn't go away for a long time. It wasn't until I read Stephen King's book on writing, where he talked about, as you're no doubt familiar, he talked about, you know, the pin that became the nail that became the spike, you know, that he would, you know, put every rejection onto as a motivator, and channeling that rejection into motivation. I had done that a little bit sort of instinctively, but when you do it purposefully, when you really, you know, focus that process, it works for you a whole lot better. And so I've never thought about rejection in the same way since.
So what, you published your first book, you said 1995?
No, I finished the first draft, which is objectively was not a good draft. Wasn't ready for prime time, for sure, in 1995. And then I started writing again about a decade later, 2004, mostly short stories for a couple of years. But then in 2006, that first book was published after having undergone some, you know, significant rewrites.
Yeah. So let's talk about that first. What's the name of that first book from 2006?
It's called Under a Raging Moon. Mm-hmm. It's a crime fiction. It's a police procedural. Which is a subgenre in crime fiction that generally focuses on the police officers as the good guys, and the emphasis isn't so much on the mystery of who did it, although it can be, but the focus is kind of on the, you know, how they did it and how the police go about trying to catch them. Mm-hmm. And so in my procedurals, that's the first in the River City series, which is up to six books now. You know, in addition to that, you know, who's the bad guy, or how do we catch the bad guy, or what's that process look like? I also wanted to feature a little bit of the humanity of those police officers, what their life was like on the job and off the job, because like any group of people that are different in some way, whether, you know, whatever those differences might be, there are a lot of stereotypes and a lot of things that people think about police officers that may or may not be true.
Yeah.
And I felt like sharing kind of that human side of what they go through both on and off the job was important. Important to me. So that was one of the emphases of the series.
I get that. Yeah. So when you publish this the first book in 2006. You were still a police officer. Did you publish under your name?
No. The natural paranoia of the police officer definitely was in play there. But also the thing of it was is even before the novel, I was writing short stories, and the short stories were pretty gritty. And some of them, you know, a couple of them had cops doing bad things too. You know, I wrote some bad cop stories as well as good cop stories. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know how my bosses were going to react to that. And in the state I work in, there, you know, there is a police union, but there's a fair amount of control that the police department has over what they call outside employment, if it's related to police work in any way. And even if it isn't, you still have to get it approved. So you want to, you know, have a construction side business, you do have to get it approved. Now, those just go right through because there's no connection to law enforcement unless you're called, you know, unless you're using a badge as your, you know, company icon or something like that. Uh-huh. But writing crime fiction, there's a pretty easy nexus there to, you know, being a police officer. So I figured if I used a, you know, a pen name and I was vague about where I worked and I changed Spokane to River City, that I was giving myself enough of a cushion that if my bosses said, no, you want to write, wait till your career's over, you know, and I wasn't going to do that, I would have fought that. So at least then I'd have some ammunition, you know, to win that argument. And so Frank Zaffiro was born.
Okay, so Frank Zaffiro is your pen name.
That's correct. It's the pen name that I use for crime fiction.
Okay. So first, when you published your first one, was that independent or was that through a publishing house?
That was through a very small publisher called Wolfmont Press. I mean, it was basically a one-man show in Georgia.
How did that feel when they said, yes, we'll publish?
Oh, pretty awesome. I mean, it's, I mean, it's that, you think back to when you were, you know, a kid and you wanted to have a book published and you wanted to be a writer. And then you know, I experienced all of those rejections and letdowns and starts and stops and obstacles and so forth. And then, you know, started having some success in the short story field for it to culminate in, you know, your book coming out with your name on the cover, or a name that you picked anyway. And the biggest piece is your story. The story you want to share is now being shared. It's now out there and anybody can read it that wants to. It's not just an idea in your head. It's not in the cupboard. It's out on the table. And so it was a pretty fantastic feeling. It's like falling in love for the first time. I mean, it's that impactful.
Now in 2006, so I mean, Amazon was big in 2006. 2006 wasn't that long ago. But was your book, what I'm really trying to get at, did you read reviews that bothered you?
You know, Amazon, I don't remember Amazon being as big then. I mean, the first book didn't even come out. The first two books didn't even come out as eBooks. I mean, eBooks were still, you know, buying a CD-ROM and reading it on your computer. Those were still eBooks. So, I don't remember how big Amazon was at the time. It's certainly not the gigantic, force that it is now. But so yeah, you know,
they weren't ordering your book on Amazon.
Oh, like, I'm sure they were. Sure they were. I know that most of the sales occurred. I mean, I was responsible for a large number of the sales. I went to the bookstores in the town I worked in and, you know, set up, bookstore appearances and, you know, was that lonely writer at the table when you walk into the bookstore, you know, and I was pretty successful in doing that. In that, you know, I conveyed the energy of the book and my own excitement, and you know, compared to outside of the big name people who came in, you know, the people there, the book managers were always, you know, very pleased with the numbers. I'm sure Amazon had some of the sales as well. You know, with reviews at that point, I think I tend to take things personally anyway, you know, like that's just a flaw in my personality. So if you like me, it means a lot to me. If you don't like me, it also means a lot to me. Like, yeah. I mean, I just, yeah. it's a personality flaw, honestly, I think I've come to believe. And so here's your first book. It's your baby. It's like somebody saying your kid's ugly. You know, I mean, it's, you know, so did I take them personally? And was I devastated by them? Yeah, for sure. You know, luckily they were good ones as well. Mm-hmm. And there were a lot of good ones. And it's actually, you know, I mean, it's been published now for, you know, what is that? I'm showing my math failings, 15 years. Is that right? And, you know, I mean, it's, you know, a 4-star, you know, I don't know, 500, 600, 800 reviews, some crazy number of reviews on Amazon. You know, and so, you know, this is not a small sample size to, you know, to draw on to say that it's been well reviewed. But even still today, I mean, I just got a review on it the other day and it was a good review. And then a few weeks ago, there was a bad review, and it's like, I still do take it. You know, I mean, I'd be lying if I said I didn't notice them. I've gotten a little more philosophical about it, you know, and a little more comfortable with my own skin. And I think more of my frustration with reviews now is unfair reviews. Those do bother me. Like, I got one the other day, a few weeks ago, on a book that's highly reviewed, but the person was complaining about profanity, which there is some, you know, damn profanity in the book. but, you know, it kind of frustrates me because, I mean, you're reading a book written by a guy whose tagline is gritty crime fiction from both sides of the badge. Mm. Reading police procedural about the topic of that book, which was a kidnapping. You know, might you run into some profanity? Yeah, probably so. And if you don't like that, that's fine. But don't ding the book because it is exactly what it says it is. If you think it's poor writing, a bad story, you know, that's fair. But, you know, 1-star because you don't like profanity and there's profanity in it when it says very clearly there's profanity in it. I don't know. That's kind of like going to a Quentin Tarantino movie and complaining about the violence. You knew what you're getting walking in, right? And so 1-star because of shallow characters or dumb plot or pacing, or that's cool. But I don't know. That's where my frustrations come up more now when it comes to reviews. I've got a little thicker skin.
But do you respond to them?
Oh, you can't anymore. You used to be able to.
Oh, okay. Okay.
But you can't anymore on Amazon anyway. Yeah. And even when I could, I only responded to two. I responded to one where the guy reviewed one book, but he was clearly reviewing another. And I mean, it wasn't even close. I mean, he was reviewing a book that has poker as the backdrop. That's one of the Anya trilogy books, Queen of Diamonds. And the one he was reviewing was about a retired cop and Vietnam veteran kind of going on a post-retirement adventure. Mm-hmm. And all he talked about was poker and, you know, characters from this other book and stuff. And he didn't like it. It was a 1 or 2-star review. And all I said was, thanks for your honest review. I think you're reviewing this one. Would you mind, you know, moving it over? Of course, they didn't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the only other one I responded to was somebody, you know, I've done a number of collaborations, as you mentioned. And one of the reviews, somebody didn't like the book and they accused me of kind of doing the James Patterson thing of teaming up with someone and then they write the book and I put my name on it with them, and that's all I did. And that irked me a little bit because I wrote my half of the book. You know, it was two characters and I wrote one of them, and so I made it very polite. I most certainly did write this character, and, you know, and of course there's no response to that either. So but I think it's generally, you know, it's that old wrestling with the pig idea when it comes to responding to reviews. You know, you're going to appear petulant and you're going to appear like you're, you know, a little soft feelings author. And, you know, and you're not going to change the mind of the person that read it. And all you maybe are going to do is maybe give more credence to their poor review for other people who are reading it. So, right. Tend to not to.
I self-published a book in 2009, a children's book, and I had there was one review that was not, but I didn't respond. I feel like I was actually talking with a friend about this the other day, because he's of the opinion that you respond to everything, but not, you don't engage in any type of back and forth, but you could say, thank you for your review, I'm sorry you didn't like it type of thing. I feel like, why even waste my time with someone who just didn't like it. It's just, I just don't want to engage in that energy.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. I just don't think there's anything to gain from it. Mm-hmm. The reviews aren't there for me. They're not there for you. They're there for prospective readers.
Yeah.
And I don't think me saying thank you for your honest review is going to change their mind one way or the other. And certainly arguing with them is going to change their mind, but not in the way that I might like.
Right. Yeah. So
I completely agree with you.
Yeah. Okay. So since you mentioned collaborating with authors, let's talk about that, because you've collaborated with 5 authors over a span of about a dozen books or so.
16 now.
Well, 16. Okay. So how does that work? Because when I think about the idea of collaborating with an author, that's 2 different voices that you have to make sound like one voice, right? If it's one book.
Yeah, it's worked for me in 2 different ways, 2 different styles, I guess. The first style and the way I started was that each of us, the writer that I was working with and myself, took one character and we each wrote that character in the first person. And then we wrote chapters that alternated. So you had a dual first person narrative with alternating chapters, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the first book was actually Some Degree of Murder that I wrote with Colin Conway. So I would write a Tower chapter in the first person. Then he wrote a Virgil Kelly chapter, first person, and then boom, 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 all the way through.
You're one character, the other author's a different character.
Right, right. And so the differing voice is actually a feature,
yeah,
you know, of that style. And it works really, really well. And I did that with all of the Jim Wilski novels, the Anya novels, all 4 of those. I did that with the Barney Paulson one. I did that with the Eric Beatmere one. So the majority of them I did that way. But then I was approached by another writer, Lawrence Kelter, and he wanted to write a book together. And so I explained this process to him, and I went into a little more detail, but that, you know, the basic process of it. And he said, oh, that's cool, but I don't want to do that. I was like, okay, well, what do you want to do? And he's like, we can do first person because you seem to like that, but I just want one character. And I was a little hesitant, to be honest with you, for exactly the reason that you mentioned. I felt like this character, Mocha, John Mochaccino, was going to come out schizophrenic. You know, he'd sound like me, and then he'd sound like Larry, and he'd sound like me. And so, but I'm like, hey, you know, I'll try it. What do I have to lose except time and effort, which is actually quite a lot, but you know, we'll give it a go. And so
time is our biggest asset, Frank.
I know. Foolish way to think, right? I got lucky. I've actually been very lucky where it comes to collaborations for a variety of reasons, but this was one of them. And so in that one, we didn't do chapter by chapter. We kind of did chunk by chunk, and maybe one chapter, maybe 3 chapters, just kind of, you know, we had a good story outline. So it's like, why don't you take it to here and then I'll pick it up. And like I said, really frightened of this schizophrenic character being the outcome. And the way that we avoided that, because when we got to the end of it, it wasn't my voice, it wasn't his voice, it was a third different voice. And how that happened was that we both took a very heavy-handed approach when it came to editing. And it didn't matter who wrote it, the editing, we came down hard on all of it. And so by the time it went through the revision process, if it was schizophrenic at all at the end of the first draft, it no longer was. It was this third voice that was consistent throughout, and so my fears were not realized there, and that worked really well, and so it worked so well that then I changed it all up, and I haven't done the dual first person narrative since.
What are the advantages of doing it the way that you now do it, where it's just one voice but 2 different people? Because it seems like logically the way you were doing it before makes more sense, but it's 2 different characters. But this other way magically worked very well. Why not just have one person write that one voice? Like, what's the advantage of having 2 different people do it?
Well, I mean, you know, 2 minds, 4 eyes, right? I mean, you're gonna have a greater breadth of ideas. Of course, when you're working together, you can develop a synergy, so you can work harder and faster than you do on your own. But from a story standpoint or a plot standpoint, you just bring more ammunition to the table. You bring more creative energy to the table. Mm-hmm. And so, and let's face it, a dual first person narrative works for some stories. And I mean, it worked for a lot of stories, the ones that I was telling, but it's not a format that's going to work for every kind of story you're trying to tell. I mean, the next Larry Kelter book that we wrote together called Fallen City was a much more sprawling narrative that couldn't be told through just one POV. And so that's why we adapted to that. And the books that I've written since then with Colin Conway, the Charlie 316 series, also multiple points of views, I wouldn't call it an epic story, but a pretty broad story with a lot of different things going on at once. And so trying to write it in that dual first person narrative just wouldn't have worked. And honestly, the way it works now, if you can imagine, like if you and I are writing it together under this process, after we do all of the pregame work that needs to be done, creating a pretty detailed roadmap so we both know where we're going, mm-hmm. the writing process would work like I'd write chapter one or one, two, and three, whatever we agreed on. I'd write chunk one, send it to you. You get it. You read that chunk and immediately go in and do your initial revisions on it, like comments and line edits. And then you write chunk two.
Okay.
And then send it back to me. Now I read chunk one that I wrote, accept or reject or comment, do whatever I'm going to do, this ongoing revision to this first chapter, if you will. I go in, I do my revisions and line edits and comments to your chapter two or second chunk there. And then I write the third.
Okay.
And then we do that, volley it back and forth, back and forth, back and forth until the book is finished. And by doing that, two things happen. One, kind of like that initial fear of schizophrenia that became a third, voice, that happens. It becomes much more our book rather than your part of the book and my part of the book of our book. And the second thing is by the time you get to the end of the first draft, it's really the end of the second draft.
Because you've been revising.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. It's much tighter. And you resolve potential problems that might come up later, much earlier, because you see something, you comment on it. Colin and I especially have, running comments on the side of each successive exchange that we identify issues. Sometimes we table them and come back to them later. Sometimes we resolve them over the course of two or three exchanges. And that informs what you do moving forward. Well, this character is too angry. We don't want him to be that angry until this event happens, because this event is, a very, so this is the catalyst for their anger. So let's make him moody instead of outright angry. And so I didn't write four more chapters of this character being angry. I wrote those chapters, that character being moody, and rather than having to go back and change, three or four chapters later on after the entire book is finished. And so there's a benefit to it there.
I really find this really interesting, because the first thing I thought of when you were describing the process is this game, as I'm an English teacher, that I would play with my, I don't know if it's a game, maybe an exercise is a better way to say it, where you have a student start a story with like a paragraph, and they pass it to the next student, and they read it, and then they add to it, and they pass it to the next student. And so you just never know what you're going to come up with. But it sounds like you guys plan it out beforehand, or is there an element of surprise where you're like, oh, look what they added, I wasn't expecting that.
The surprises are small ones. Oh, look at that funny comeback. Oh, look at the way he handled that particular scene. But you knew what was going to be handled. Because we do come up with a pretty detailed roadmap, I would say, a chapter by chapter outline, which may only be a few lines to describe what happens in the chapter, and maybe a couple of pieces of dialogue to sort of show the tone or something. Mm-hmm. And there's always room to make changes. I mean, we can throw the brakes on at any time and say, oh, I had this great idea. What if, this person actually does know this, but is hiding it because of this? What do you think? And we might go, oh yeah, let's go through the outline and add that in where we need to, so we'll have it when we come up. But that didn't happen a ton. We actually did most of the brainstorming prior to the actual writing. And so there weren't any huge surprises. but there were very pleasant small ones, you know, I mean, chuckles because of the way dialogue was handled, or perspective maybe, or the way something was described, you know, that's a total surprise because you haven't read it yet. So, you know, it's like going to a movie and you kind of know, you know, what the basic plot's going to be, but the performance and the music and the cinematography is all still a pleasant surprise to you.
Yeah. And now that you've explained that process to me, I really like it. I like that there are two minds coming together with their creativity. I mean, that sounds really cool.
Well, so, it goes back to that thing I said earlier with Carrie Provost, you know, that fellowship idea. I mean, when I wrote Charlie 316 with Colin Conway, we really kind of refined the process that Larry and I came up with in the books that we wrote together. We were just hauling through it. Once we got the outline going, it took us 3 weeks to write almost 100,000 words of the first draft, which to me is just, I mean, that's incredibly rapid. It's breakneck speed. And part of the reason is because of that fellowship. You know, I mean, I'm excited for you to read what I just wrote. Mm-hmm. So I feel good about it. I send it to you. Now I'm excited because I'm going to get something back from you. And then I get it. I'm excited to read it and make comments on it. And now I'm excited to jump in and write mine. And I don't want to put it off until tomorrow. Maybe I'll write an extra 1,000 words today because you're waiting for me. Mm-hmm. And so there's that drive as well. And so there's a lot of benefits to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that getting the feedback. And then I think the motivation comes in being you're held accountable, really. The other person's holding you accountable to keep moving forward. Yeah.
And it's sort of a noble accountability because you can hold yourself accountable, but that's kind of selfish accountability, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's good, don't get me wrong, it's self-discipline.
Yeah.
But it's kind of, you know, when you're accountable to somebody else, it's like just like anything else. I mean, people who have workout partners or dieting partners or whatever,
right,
you know, more likely to go to the gym on a day that they might have tried to skip, and then they're, you know, because their partner's counting on them to be there to spot them, you know, and it has that same dynamic to it.
Yeah, that's great. That's wonderful. Okay, Frank, I can't believe it's all 40 minutes has passed by already. Can you believe it? But I want you to talk about your experience as a hybrid author. Can you explain what that is and talk about that? Yeah,
a hybrid author, at least as I define it, and I think most people would define it this way, is an author who is traditionally published in some fashion and has also published some of their titles independently. So what people still call self-publishing as well. And for a long time, I was only traditionally published, albeit by very small presses. And then I was traditionally published by a very small press for print, but I self-published the ebook versions because they weren't interested in publishing ebooks at the time. That was around 2010. Or so, and up until very recently, I maintained that kind of dual, you know, one foot in each stream sort of approach, because there are advantages and disadvantages to each, and for a long time my thought was, you know, I want to enjoy the advantages of each of these, because, you know, with self-publishing, with traditional or with independent publishing, control is the biggest advantage, right? You have control over everything that you could possibly have control over because you're the publisher. Of course, the disadvantage is you bear all the financial weight of that, and including the marketing and so forth and the publishing costs. And you have no one to blame but yourself if you fail.
Yeah.
Of course, the traditional route has the advantages of you have a publisher who is ostensibly doing the marketing and certainly is picking up all the costs associated with publishing. And so there's that advantage. Of course, the disadvantage is exactly what the advantage of independent publishing is, and that is less control, less input.
Right.
And generally, the bigger the press that you're dealing with, the greater the disparity of control. Like, I mean, large New York publishers can and do change titles, give little or no consideration to the author's input on covers and so forth. But they're also spending a ton on marketing, and your book is in Walmart. So, you know, and in the bookstores at the airport and, you know, at all the libraries. On the rack north, you know, nationwide. So it's a trade-off. And, you know, what do you do? And so, you know, I for a long time played both sides, I guess. And And I think that works for some people. And so do being exclusive in one or the other. For myself, I reached a point where the publisher I was with was just not doing the marketing. They did a great job on the covers. They did a great job on the layouts. They did a great job, you know, in all of those areas, but there just wasn't any marketing happening. And so that kind of stalled things. And it also hampered me a little bit because I could only do marketing for those titles that I independently published. I mean, I could market these other ones, but that kind of goes against the whole purpose of being with a publisher, right? I mean, I'm paying 100% of the marketing for 50% of the royalties. That made no sense to me. And so ultimately, just earlier this year, I elected to take my books back from that publisher and publish them all myself so that I could coordinate all of my marketing efforts and everything together. Because ultimately, I kind of came to the conclusion that, you know, a publisher can only do a couple of things for you that you can't do for yourself. I mean, you can hire an editor, and you can hire an editor every bit as good as any editor working for a publishing house. It may be expensive, but you can do it, and you should. You should always edit.
Yes.
Clearly, you know, you can hire a book designer to design your covers and to lay out your interiors, and those will be every bit. If you spend the money, it'll be every bit as much of quality as any published. Traditionally published book. Really, the only two things I saw a publisher doing that I couldn't necessarily do for myself at the time was marketing, which I came to realize that I can do that for myself. I just have to engage in that, and that's a lot of work, and it's expensive, and so forth. But it is something that many traditionally or independently published authors do quite effectively, and I'm learning to do. And the other thing was just, you know, cachet. The other thing was just, there's something to be said for my book came out from Tor or Forge or Minotaur or Simon & Schuster or whatever. There's that credibility factor that comes with, you know, still is there for traditional publishing.
Right.
You know, things change slowly. They don't change overnight. And the landscape of the publishing world, while it has changed, still gives a certain sort of credibility to traditional publishing that it doesn't give to independent publishing. And, you know, I had to weigh how much of that I was getting from the publisher I was with and how much that weighed against the no marketing and the, you know, all the other factors that I talked about. And ultimately, I came to the conclusion that I would be best off right now to independently publish all of my titles. And so that's kind of where I've gone. But, you know, the whole your mileage may vary thing is so true in the publishing world. There are some people who absolutely should go 100% independent publishing, and they're going to be most successful doing that. There are other people who should get an agent and go shoot for traditional publishing because that's how they will be most successful. And I think it's akin to that old, you know, which martial art is best argument, you know, the answer is none of them. They all have their own strengths and weaknesses, you know, and so you just kind of decide what's best for you. What are you trying to achieve? Who are you? How does it mesh with who you are as a person? It's the same thing with your publishing journey, I think, you know?
Yeah. I'm glad you said that because that it really depends on the individual as far as what works for them, that not one of these, the going through a traditional publishing house or doing something independently, not one is innately better than the other. I think a lot of us give a lot of heft and credibility to the traditional publisher. I don't know why. I think, well, you know what? I think it is.
It's always been.
Yeah, that's what it's always been. And I think that, excuse me, Frank, my nose is running. I think that there's this stigma against self-publishing because they think it's not going to be as good quality as a traditional publisher.
And sometimes they're right.
Exactly. Yeah. But if you take the time, as you said, to hire an editor and a book designer and you have a good story, then you can produce something very comparable, if not better, than what goes through a traditional publishing house.
Well, yeah, don't tell me that you haven't picked up a book published by Del Rey or Ballantine or Penguin or whoever, and it was absolute dreck. I mean,
exactly, yeah.
And with typos in it. I mean, it happens. Now, does that happen more frequently in independently published titles because there's less gatekeeping? Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to argue that it doesn't. I'm just saying that just because a book is traditionally published doesn't mean it's a good book.
Right.
And just because a book is independently published doesn't mean it wasn't good enough to be traditionally published and is a bad book. These are archaic paradigms that people are still hanging on to. You know, it's what's best for you, I think, is what you should consider.
Now, I have I'm going to have a few final questions. Actually, maybe just one final question. How did, going back to your career and infusing your career into your writing, because you mentioned that you wanted people to understand or see the humanity of law enforcement. What was the biggest observation you had, or what did you learn most about people as a law enforcement officer? Like, is there any huge lesson that sticks out as far as maybe a misconception you had about law enforcement officers or criminals or whoever that was kind of cleared or illuminated for you on the job?
You know, it's a great question. And I don't know that that's one I've been asked before, at least not in that way. And I hope my answer doesn't disappoint you, because it's going to sound very glaringly obvious. But what I learned in my law enforcement career about people is that people are just people. And what I mean by that is we often see only the surface of people and which surface we choose to focus on. So as a law enforcement officer, a lot of times people just saw the badge or the uniform. They didn't see the person wearing that. And they reacted to that badge and that uniform. Maybe it was with respect. Maybe it was with fear. Maybe it was with positive or negative feelings, but they reacted to, just like somebody might react to somebody because they have black or brown skin, or because they are tall or short or fat or skinny, or, Christian or Jewish or Muslim. I mean, you pick your difference that we assign to people. And a lot of times all we do in this world is we latch onto that facet, and that's how we see the person. And I'm as guilty as that as anyone. I'm not trying to say I'm not. In fact, the last couple of years have taught me anything, it's how much I still fell prey to that, and not in a malicious way, but in a benign way that could still be, have negative results. Mm-hmm. And so I've really struggled to remember this lesson, because, there's a real person behind that badge who it may or may not fit the stereotype that you have of him or her. Likewise, as I went and contacted people, some of them, who were criminals for a living, they were human beings too. And when you learned, I guess when I learned to start seeing people as an individual and as a person, and to try to take what was happening in that light, and to not attach my prejudices or my preconceptions to the reality of that situation and to who they were, it was a pretty profound lesson. And it allowed me to handle situations in a way that most of the time was far more effective, because, people appreciate being seen for who they at least think they are, and certainly as an individual rather than a symbol. And I think that's true in any setting. Regardless of whether we're talking about a police officer and a citizen or criminal or whatever. And it's just something that really stuck with me. And so as I wrote that series, I wanted to show cops being people, just people. I wanted to show criminals sometimes being just people. Yeah, the person did a horrible thing and they need to go to jail, or maybe you hate them, but at least you know that they're, not just this stereotypical thing. They're a real person, and maybe here's why they did that. And maybe we can't forgive it, but we can at least understand it. And these sorts of considerations, and that's continued throughout my career and into the Charter 316 series that I wrote with Colin. Really delves into that concept a lot. The one I'm writing now, which is going to be part of that universe, really delves into current events surrounding that sort of concept, and that maybe we should stop being a society that only looks at the headline of a situation or a person and makes a decision about the entire content of that person or situation.
Did you learn to be more empathetic? Because that's what it sounds like.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Uh-huh. Which goes against the grain of what that experience usually pushes you towards, to be perfectly mm-hmm. honest with you.
Right.
Usually cynicism is the end destination, you know, yeah. and empathy kind of slows down that process and you become less cynical and not as quickly. And I'm not saying I didn't suffer from cynicism and I didn't, you know, say my share of insensitive things or I was always a perfect gentleman to everybody and I always treated everybody with more respect than they'd even deserved, you know, if that's possible to do. Mm. But it was a guiding principle that I tried to adhere to and looking back, I feel like I was successful more often than not in adhering mm-hmm. to it. Mm-hmm. And I tried to bring that into my storytelling as well.
What was the biggest thing you wanted people to understand about you when you were an officer that you felt they just didn't understand?
That is such a good question. And I try to find a way to distill it down because it's a huge question because there are so many things. But ultimately, I guess it comes down to that there's more than meets the eye. There are more factors into what is happening here than what you get in a, you know, 2 second snapshot mm-hmm. of the situation. And because as a police officer, you're bound by the law, you're bound by case law, you're bound by policy, you're bound by societal expectations. And sometimes those can be a pretty rigid, framework to try to work within. You know, sometimes I had to take people to jail. I didn't want to take to jail, but I didn't have a choice. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I couldn't take someone to jail that really, really deserved to go, mm-hmm. but I couldn't because I didn't have legal justification for doing so. Even if there's a lot of moral justification.
Yeah.
And sometimes people would take a look at a situation like that and they'd make an immediate judgment based on it. And what I wanted people to know was, no, this is a thoughtful outcome. Whatever this is, and it's dictated by law, it's dictated by case law, it's dictated by policy, it's dictated by society, it's dictated by me doing the very best job I can in this moment. And so I guess, you know, that almost like hit the pause on your judgment for just a second, take in a little bit more before you then push play again and decide what you are going to decide about this situation.
Mm-hmm.
And let's be honest, you know, one thing that doesn't get said often enough is that the reverse is also true. Like as a police officer, I needed to hit that pause button and I didn't always. I made snap judgments that were unfortunately often correct when you go through and look at everything and you sort through it, you find out, yeah, I was right. But that doesn't make it any more right that I made that snap judgment. And we suffer. I say we have been retired since 2013. So,
yeah.
But we suffered from a, you know, form of blue blindness that was every bit as fatal as what some civilians, you know, yeah. suffer from when they look at the police. So, you know, that's to me, that was the key is let's hit the pause button and let all the facts settle down and the dust settle just a little bit on whatever situation or person we're looking at and then make a decision. And then we may still disagree, but at least then we're doing it from a much more reasonable position.
Yeah. That's a great spiritual lesson, Frank, just to hit pause. Hit pause.
It's hard to do.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You know.
Thank you so much for sharing that. Well,
thanks for a great question.
Yeah. I really enjoyed this conversation. Goodness.
I have too.
Tell us where we can find you, Frank.
Really easy. FrankZaffiro.com is my website and you can pretty much link to everything from there. But of course I'm on Amazon and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you again. And I'm going to stop recording, but I'm just going to chat with you for a moment. But Frank Zaffiro, thank you so much. Did I say it right?
Yes, you did.
Okay. I thought you'd give me that look.
No, I was just wondering if I had time to say thanks for having me because
you do.
I really do appreciate it. I have a podcast and I spend time promoting other authors through it. And I know the effort that goes into that. And so,
yeah. What is the name of your podcast?
It's called Wrong Place, Right Crime.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. I thought that was such a great title when I saw that. I was like, oh, that's
my wife came up with it. So.
Oh, wow. Smart woman. Okay.
What an enlightening conversation. I don't think I've talked so extensively with a law enforcement officer, either current or former. So that was really quite fun. And I hope that you were inspired by his story, that this is something that Frank was doing at a young age, that is writing, and he was able to take his career as a law enforcement officer and infuse it into his writing and become a successful author. So if you want more information on Frank, please visit his website. And in the meantime, you can also visit zazel.com and sign up for my newsletter. And you can follow me on Twitter at Ebony Haywood and Facebook and Instagram at Motivation to Write. Thank you so much for tuning in. And I hope that I will see you next week when I talk to another fabulous person. Bye-bye.